Climb into the cockpit with pilot and Wing Square's Chief Legal Officer, Tim Perilla, as he invites legal leaders aboard to share advice that will help you navigate even the most turbulent times of in-house counsel work. We'll cover a range of topics from data privacy to legal team structure to public company transactions and beyond. You don't want to miss this series. Fasten your seatbelt and prepare for takeoff. You're listening to Cockpit Counsel.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Cockpit Counsel. My name is Tim. I'm the Chief Legal Officer at Link Squares. As always, we have our producer, Alyssa Verzino. And if you enjoy our content, give us a like, follow on all the socials, and yeah, let's get into it. So today we've got Matt Pankin. Matt is the Chief Legal Officer at Specialty Program Group. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be back in Boston.
So we start every show the same way. It's an aviation-themed podcast. What is your pre-flight ritual?
Pre-flight ritual. I've never got to my gate early enough. I would never want to sprint onto the plane. It's funny because my wife is like the complete opposite. So any of our trips are like oil and water. But I like to get through security, find my gate, you know, make sure it exists for some reason, and then go get coffee and water, whatever. So I can never get there early enough.
All right. That's hilarious. My wife and I are the same way. Like, she wants to get to the airport like 5 hours early. I'm like, what?
See, that's my perfect. Great. Let's get a newspaper. Let's enjoy ourselves. Yeah, my wife would love to literally sprint onto the plane, which is my worst nightmare.
I take pride in the fact that I went from my house to seated on an airplane in 38 minutes.
That's my worst nightmare. I mean, I'm literally getting stressed hearing you talk about this right now.
I was just like, it was like a 6:30 a.m. flight, and I was going to Mexico, and it was
the worst.
Excellent.
The worst.
Yeah. It's like super efficient.
Couldn't disagree more with that.
That's all right. So CLO over at Specialty Program Group.
Yep.
Let's talk a little bit about your career path, though. How did you end up there? Where'd you start?
I woke up and I decided as a young kid I wanted to be an insurance attorney. No, okay. It's not really how it happened, but
that's what all dreams are made of.
Yeah, exactly.
Of, right?
Yeah. Went to law school in Virginia, and you know, I'd moved a lot as a kid. I spent some time in New Hampshire, was born there in Massachusetts, and had lived kind of all over, and was sort of open to go anywhere, and had some friends in Chicago. Interviewed in Chicago in the summer, which was a great time to get convinced to go to Chicago.
Yeah.
And took a big firm job there for a couple of years, and then went to work for one of their clients, Dyson, the vacuum company.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was a lot of fun. Got to go to Malmesbury, England, where they test, you know, vacuum. There's like 100 people named Nigel there for some reason. And they're all testing vacuums. And that was a lot of fun. That was a very popular family member at that time, like free Dyson vacuum gifts and stuff.
So, yeah, yeah.
Decided to go back to a big law firm at some point. And then when I was at that second big law firm, did a lot of work for Hub International.
Okay.
Who's my company's parent company, big, you know, the top five insurance broker.
Yeah.
Was doing a lot of M&A for Hub, and then got a chance to go join Hub full time in their M&A team. And,
okay.
Was there for 8 years. And then during
how big of a team was that?
Our M&A team was legal was probably 3 or 4 folks.
Okay.
So thinly staffed, very entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
And then we, during my time at Hub, we actually formed my current company from scratch. You know, we hired 2 employees and had 0 revenue. I was able to work on their first acquisition, which brought in their first dollar, right?
Okay.
And they've grown like crazy. And then 2 years ago, the head of that company, my current employer, Specialty Program Group, they've got so big they needed their own kind of dedicated legal staff. And, and it was a good move for me. I moved over from Hub M&A to Specialty Program Group almost exactly 2 years ago.
All right.
Yeah.
Nice. So can you talk a little bit about some of the work that obviously there's it's a big M&A shop, but like, what are some of the other things that you're doing day in and day out before we get into the M&A
stuff?
Seems
like it's a little bit of everything. Obviously, Hub is a big M&A. M&A is core to their DNA, and owned by Hub, you know, we're no different. You know, we do a lot of acquisitions, but employment law, you know, labor employment, equity matters, a lot of contracts. I'm sure
yeah.
you have the same thing, contract negotiation, and with that, you know, reviewing contracts, but you know, reviewing how your own internal templates, you know, get created and that whole process, and trying to make that as painless for everyone as possible. A little bit of real estate, it's just a little bit of everything. It's, and you know, I feel like every day I've got three or four big things that I hope to get to, and then the rest of your day is like, I have no idea, right? That's part of the, fun. You never really know what you're going to wake up to.
Yeah, you kind of let the business dictate your day a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. It's fun.
Yeah, it is fun.
So, how was the transition from firm to in-house, back to firm and back to in-house?
I loved it. I mean, there's always, you kind of joke about the obvious, like, pay issues, right? When you're a big firm, they're paying you to work those hours. And, so there's always a little bit of a initial drop off, but you know, I've gone in-house for a reason. I've done it twice now. Current role, tenure. So I love it. I think there's, it kind of depends what you want for your career as an attorney, but you know, for me, it's obviously not billing hours is great, and we always joke about that, but I think realistically what that means is you're able to really sink yourself into every project that you're in. You know, I think when you're at a firm, sometimes you're always in the back of your head, there's a clock and you're tracking, you know, if I dig this deep, that's going to take me two more hours. Does the client really want me to spend that much time, you know, that time? And when you're in house, you solve the problem. Right. You do what it takes, and you're not kind of worried about how it's going to look on paper later, which is kind of freeing in a way. And I really love getting, you know, when you're in house, you get involved at a much earlier stage and you stay involved for a later stage. Right. I think sometimes, particularly being a corporate attorney or an M&A attorney at a law firm, you feel a little bit like a hired gun. You're kind of brought in, you close the deal, and you're on to the next thing.
Yeah, it's a pretty transactional.
Transactional, yeah. It's kind of you're constantly moving on. You're constantly learning a new industry, a new deal. And I think in house, you just get brought in. You know, hey Tim, you know, we're thinking about doing this. What do you think? And to be able to give your opinion that early, and then you close a deal or you sign an agreement or whatever it is, and to kind of see how that agreement actually worked or didn't work. And so you're just involved for more of the story, which I think is rewarding.
Yeah. One of the things that I love about M&A activity is actually the aftermath of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you're just like working the transaction and walking away, I feel like you're missing like 90% of the fun.
Yeah. Yeah. You have the closing dinner or whatever, and that's over. Right. It's like, well, that was fun.
But usually the closing dinners are pretty good.
Yeah. 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 No, I agree.
So, you know, when you're approaching, you know, an acquisition, I'm sure you have it down to like a system at this point.
Yep.
How has your approach changed being in-house versus being an external counsel on a transaction?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing in the way our company does M&A is we don't typically slash staff. We don't really change their staffing. So we're not closing a deal and hiring or you know, firing half their staff. And so that really, you know, as you negotiate, as you, you know, take occasionally hard positions, in the back of your head, you're always thinking, when we close this deal, you know, all these, the selling shareholders, their staff, they are going to become immediately my colleagues.
Right.
Right. And so you can't do this burn bridges. It's my way or the highway. You know, you're not as sophisticated as we are. We do this all the time. You don't do this. You can't do that, because, you know, your worst thing particularly for a company like ours that does so many acquisitions, you can't have these sellers and their staff be defeated when you get to closing.
Right.
Because day one, now they've got to produce revenue. It's, you know, we close the deal, but now it's phase two. Now it's actually like, we need you to perform and be happy to be here. And so you can't win or you know, get to closing by just constantly beating them down, you know, being difficult or obstinate. And so it really challenges you as an attorney to articulate well, be likable, even when you're taking, you know, positions they may not want to hear.
Right.
And it really pushes you to understand why you're taking a position. Because if you're telling someone, hey, you know, we're going to reject this change, or we're going to reject this request, or we can't do this, and you don't tell them why, all you do is kind of engender this, like, I'm just getting frustrated. Everything I try to do when I'm selling to your company I'm getting met with no's, no's, no's. And it really does help if you fully understand the issue and why you're why you're saying no or why you're taking a stand. It really helps the other side appreciate where you're coming from, and it makes you seem less difficult. So yeah, I think just knowing in at the end of the day, you know, it's not a win-lose. And that's why I love M&A. It really should be a win-win, right? Everybody right. should feel like we got it done. You know, there's not, no one lost, you know, no one should feel that they didn't get what they wanted. So that to me is, it's rewarding, and I think it's challenging in a good way, as an in-house attorney.
Yeah, absolutely. So as, you know, largely the acquirer, how do you think about like using deal fatigue to your advantage? Are you like just high velocity? Like, my experience has been like, sometimes we'll strategically like make a deal a little bit. Like once you get people deal pregnant, then you're kind of like, all right, we've got this.
There is that. I mean, I think especially for a seller, you know, when you're, we always talk about internally, you know, let's remember that we do this all the time.
Right.
The seller may do it once in their entire life.
That's
and,
right.
And they're selling, maybe it's a business they started, maybe it's a business their parents started or their father, mother, and they're second generation, but this is their one time to do it. And so all these things that we think are routine or simple or easy, they don't necessarily know that. So you always got to keep that in mind. There is a point where, you know, the process can be for, especially for a seller, challenging, and it's a lot, and they're being distracted from their day-to-day operation. Right. So that I think is a big thing to appreciate, that, you know, they have a business to run, and they're running the business while they're answering all your questions and going through due diligence. So you're basically giving them a second full-time job. And I do think at some point for a seller, you know, talk about getting like deal pregnant, or they've done so much work. The idea of like starting over with someone else is like the worst thing they've ever heard of.
Yeah.
So it does as a buyer,
especially if there's not a somebody else.
Yes. And then the problem is that if they don't close with you and they go to somebody else, that somebody else says, well, what went wrong? Right. So now they've got to explain why they didn't close the first time. There is a point halfway through or whatever, where I think the seller realizes like, gosh, I do not want to do this again. But it goes back to that. It works to a buyer's advantage, but it goes back to, you still got to be careful that you don't want someone to get to closing and just fall flat in their face of sheer exhaustion.
Yeah.
Right. So even if you know as a buyer, we're definitely going to close this, they can't turn back now. You know, they've told their entire staff, you still have to keep them excited and engaged. And even though, you know, like this is going to happen, they can't turn back. I think you still have to keep in mind that let's keep them excited, keep them engaged, to get to that win-win position.
Yeah, absolutely. So how would you think about things differently if you were representing or working at the company that's being acquired?
We've been on the sell side a couple of times. It's definitely, it forces you to appreciate, I think, being buy side. You know, typically when you're on buy side, it's, you know, when you're a strategic acquirer like we are, it's our form documents that I know head to toe. You know, we're starting off, it's my process, you know, it's my timeline. And as a seller, you're kind of, you're responding to the buyer request. You're reviewing the buyer's documents for the first time. And there is a little bit of discomfort as a seller. You're kind of going along with what it's the buyer's process.
Yeah.
And I think going through that as a seller, you know, we've sold books of business to other competitors in our space. But that process definitely makes you appreciate being on the buy side, to be honest. And I think it makes you a better, you know, buy side strategic attorney. So it's not always painful, but you know, it's also when you're a strategic buyer, going through the sell side and kind of seeing how other buyers operate, and you can learn a lot too.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's reassuring, like, geez, they definitely handled that in a way that I wouldn't have. And it kind of makes you feel better about your own process, or you learn some things like, hey, they did this a little bit differently. Maybe we should kind of do that a little more similar to what they do. So, I think in a way it's you definitely come out of it with a lot of, education.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it also brings a bit of real world empathy to the table where you're like, I've sat in that seat before.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's just not fun.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think for us too, I mean, we would often close, even at SPG where I am now, or at, you know, Hub, our parent, probably often, you know, 9-10 deals a month. And you get to this thing that you've got to fight is this idea that the M&A is like commoditized.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's tough because we'd always close all our deals, you know, usually, you know, month end, just for accounting purposes. And so you'd literally the day of closing, you'd get off one closing call, change someone's life, get on to the next call, change that person's life with these like multi-million dollar payments. And you got to fight this idea that like, it's such a significant day for them. And as a strategic buyer, you almost kind of forget. It's just boom, boom, boom down the assembly line. But for you, it's just part of your job. But for these sellers, I mean, that's, again, it's like a lifetime goal, right? It's a transitional, you know, transformational moment for them. And you got to, as a buyer, kind of realize that, not appreciate that.
Yeah, exactly. There's definitely an element of like, you've worked so hard to build this business and you can finally sell it. And like, maybe you're happy, maybe you're not. I mean, I've been through a couple of these on the sell side, and it's just like, man, you question everything, but you're grateful for what you have to a certain extent.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's almost like this weight that's lifted off your shoulders, but it's, are you a fan of The Simpsons? You ever watch The Simpsons?
Yeah. It's been a while, but
All right. You remember the episode where, Homer Simpson had like the stone of shame around his neck and then they saw like the birthmark and they're like, now attach the stone of triumph and it's like 10 times bigger.
It's
like a little bit of that that goes on where it's like you take that weight off your shoulders, but you oftentimes put an even bigger weight.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many times we'll have a closing call and you do your kind of congratulations, yada, yada. And then we'll say, all right, well, tomorrow morning, now you work for us and we gotta produce business. And we're kind of half joking.
Right.
But yeah.
How, on average, how big are the deals that you're doing?
That's, you know, the fun part about being at SPG and Hub International, and again, being a strategic buyer, is the variety of deals is great. You know, we've done deals where, you know, I did a Canadian deal for Hub where it was like 400 employees, right? And, you know, tons of locations. You know, we do deals that are 10 people, 5 people, right? One location. And so that variety, I think, is a lot of fun. It's a totally different deal. I mean, it really is.
Right.
You know, how are you going to get everybody signed up to their employment agreements? You know, if it's a 10-person shop, you might say every person's crucial. We got to get everybody on board. It's 400. That's a tall ask, right? Are you going to go 400 for 400 and getting all the employees to come over? Probably not. So what's the right amount that you need to keep the business running? So the variety is really rewarding if you're up for that challenge. The different personalities, you know, the bigger deals, if we're paying 100 million, 200, whatever million dollars, they're probably going to get sophisticated deal counsel. And so it changes how you act as an attorney. We always joke about, not to pick on New York, but I'm from Chicago, you're from Boston, we can pick on New York.
Yeah, of course.
You know, we always have those deals where you realize, oh no, they're using a high priced, you know, New York City attorney. Yeah. We got to kind of put our
New York scan.
Yeah, hey, here exactly. Right, here we go. Here we go. We're gonna have some battles about, you know, who's smarter here and who's never seen this before in their entire career and that whole game. Yes, but that's, I think that helps sharpen your sword.
Yeah.
I really love having to be a bit of a chameleon when you're in house. And I mean that in not in a pejorative sense. Like it's fun to, you know, if we're doing a deal, it's 10 people and it's a small Alaska law, you know, small Alaska deal, that seller and that attorney are gonna be different than that New York City attorney, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so that's fun to do both. I think it makes you better. The variety is really exciting.
Yeah.
But it changes your whole message. I mean, we always joke about some of our smaller deals, you know, the attorney they hire is like a former trust and estates guy. You're like, that I wouldn't hire like a wrist doctor to do my heart surgery.
Right.
But I wouldn't hire like a trust and estates attorney to do my deal. But it happens. And maybe it's probably a friend of theirs from way back, whatever, in the neighborhood. And
we'll do it more or less for free.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Pizza and beer.
Yes.
Right?
Shockingly, the cost was probably what made the decision there.
Yeah.
But being in a situation like that where maybe you have to be a little more patient with that with that attorney.
Yeah.
Explain more, you know, don't think of all their questions as silly or kind of stupid questions.
Yeah.
Then you have that New York City attorney. We keep picking on New York.
Yeah.
They're the worst. Yeah. Hopefully no one from New York is listening.
I hope everybody from New York is listening.
Just those big firm. Yeah. Right. But yeah, you do a deal like that and you got to kind of dust off your deal studies and deal reports and you've got to be much more ready to talk about, you know, what's market, why are we not market here, you know, what's, and so that it just, both those types of deals I think really make you a better attorney, but yeah, you got to change your style, right? And talk about being a chameleon.
It's a completely different approach, right? I mean, yeah, you get someone there and you've got to, you know, you've got to figure out a way to diffuse it because yep, they're, I mean, when you're paying $1,300-$1,400 an hour, yep, for the partner who's not doing, yep, any work,
yep,
but, you know, is talking to you about, yep, God knows what,
yeah,
like they have to put on some sort of show.
Yeah.
Like they,
yeah,
can't just be like, yeah, you're perfectly reasonable and just move, yep, on with their lives.
Yeah.
So your client's going to be like, what the hell am I paying you $1,400 an hour for?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And they've got to justify their own existence.
Yeah.
I feel like I've had all the, thankfully few, but the few like screaming matches over the phone have been with those big,
yeah,
those big, big law firm attorneys. And you just have to, you know, you've got to find a way to kind of, you know, put your shell on and not let it affect you. But, yeah, it's just different, you know, different sellers, different attorneys.
Yeah.
But again, I think that's when you're in house, if you can really, if that type of challenge, you know, changing your approach and being flexible excites you, then it's great. It's really rewarding.
Yeah. Personally, I really like that. I love dealing, yeah, with big firms.
Yeah.
Because I like the battle.
Yeah.
Because I don't really get to do it that often,
yeah, yeah,
working in house.
Yeah.
So, a lot of my time, yeah, is spent with like people who you just can't battle because, yeah, of, yeah, that relationship. Yeah. Yeah. You're like, all right, we're just going to hate each other by the end of this.
Yeah.
But if there's like a big law firm on the, yeah, other side of that, I'm like, all right, you're the villain, not your client.
Yeah.
This is good.
Yeah.
Let's have,
yeah,
some fun.
Yeah, exactly. And it encourages you. I think, you know, when you're in house, maybe you kind of, you yearn for those like sophisticated battles that you had maybe when you were at a big firm. It allows you to kind of, you know, dust those skills off and,
yeah,
and do it.
Sharpen the elbows.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. Thinking about the business side of it, and obviously being a part of the organization post close.
Yep.
What are some of the things that you think about, and how do you like follow up post deal to help ensure success?
You know, it's always we're a thinly staffed team. I think you are too. It's always like you want to be proactive, but sometimes, and maybe we shouldn't say this out loud, the more you ask about, you know, the more work you get. So there's, sure, always a little bit of like, you got to be careful. Not that you hide in your office and make it hard to reach you, but you know, it's funny. We have so many diverse businesses at SPG. You know, 29, 30 different divisions. They're all special snowflakes. They're all unique in their own way. And you would never go to one of them and say, "How's it going? Is everything great?" And they would never say, "Everything's great. I've got no problems." Right. So, right, you're always a little bit like, you know, you gotta be ready. Right. So like, when you go ask, you know, how someone's doing, you know, can I help you out with anything? You gotta be ready because they're gonna give you something, right? Like, oh, right, funny you should ask. You know, here's my, there's a little bit of that, but you know, I think when we close, you know, there's a fair amount of like standardization, and so, you know, the process for me is okay. Now we've gotten to closing, and you've done things your own way. You know, maybe you had an in-house attorney, maybe you didn't really have anybody on call to handle your legal needs. Now you're coming to our company and we do things a certain way, right? And not that the way you're doing it was wrong, but this is how we do things. And that's always a little bit of a process.
How do you fold in, like, yeah, for companies that do, yep, have in-house attorneys, yep, that stay on, yep, post-acquisition?
I love it. That's a good problem to have. I mean, I'll take any help I can get. So yeah, it doesn't happen that often. But I wish it actually would happen more.
Yeah.
if you're like,
sweet, our team's bigger.
Like, great, this is great, yeah. Yeah, but I think, you know, we try to, like, during the deal, talk about, you know, post-closing integration. You don't want to do it in a way that's distracting from, sure, the mission to get to closing. So there's a little bit of like, give them a little bit of a hint, and then after closing, you kind of really get into it. But in a lot of ways, it's the same style you had pre-closing, right? Like making sure you explain things, and this is the way we do things here. It's differently than maybe how you did it, but this is why, right? And you know, it's I think the challenge for a company like ours when we really grow a lot through acquisition. And so, you know, we're 29, 30 different previous agencies that are all coming together. And so you've got 30 different ways of doing things, right? And how do you decide, okay, let's let them do this 30 different ways in this matter, because it makes sense. But on these things, we got to all do it the same way. We can't run 30 different directions. And deciding, you know, internally what the right, not that they're battles, but what's the right battle to pick. And when we kind of come out of our leadership teams and say, hey, we're gonna have all 30 divisions and brands do it this way, you kind of got to get ready, because you're going to get some, this is silly, why do we have to do it this way? And, you know, the way we did it wasn't, you know, wasn't broke. And you got to be kind of united in that front. But we've had success. I think you got to find the right blend of what makes sense to let people do their own way, what makes sense to say, hey guys, I'm sorry, this is the way. We can't have 30 different styles of employment agreements. We can't have 30 different types of like template agreements. Like, it's just not efficient.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, transitioning a little bit to advice for our listeners.
Sure.
So how do you show the rest of the organization that you're not trying to be difficult during, you know, maybe a harder conversation?
Yeah, I think that's always, for any in-house counsel, that's the thing you're always battling against, is you don't want to be the department of no or the internal police, right? And I think you have to kind of realize that, fortunately or unfortunately, that's the starting position. I think people assume, you know, everyone has jokes about attorneys and whatever, but I think you have to realize you're starting from a position of that internal stakeholder, that business person probably thinks you're a department of no.
Right.
Because someone told them, hey, you got to run it by Matt. You got to run it by Tim.
Right.
And who's Tim? Where's Tim's office? And hey, Tim, you know, told me I'm supposed to talk to you. And so you got to realize that's you need to prove them wrong.
Yeah. They're like, right? Yeah. They're like, here we go.
Here we go. Right. You know, you're going to tell me all the ways my contract is wrong, whatever. And you're going to hold up my, you know, deal, whatever. And so you realize it's up to you to kind of prove them wrong.
Yeah.
And I think the ways you prove them wrong are really listening, right? You've got it. You can't make any assumptions. You've got to listen to what they're trying to achieve. And, you know, you're going to have some things that, hey, you can't do it that way, or we don't do it that way here, but we can do it this way. And so constantly kind of like a, you know, carrot and stick, like, don't just give them the stick and say, no, you can't do this, you know, go away, try again.
Right.
You know, you can't do it, but have you thought about this? And I think that listening, and again, you know, SPG, we've got 30 different special businesses and they're all a little bit different. And, you know, all they want to do is they want people to appreciate that their particular business is unique. And the more you can listen and acknowledge that, I think goes a long way. So again, I think listening, don't assume, you know, don't just say no. If you need to say no, which you have to say no a lot, shockingly, you know, no, but do it this way. And I think it's related to that, but don't just be a processor of tasks. Don't just be like, yeah, I go to Tim and I tell him I need a contract, and he gives me a contract 2 days later.
Right.
You know, ask questions. Say like, hey, you asked me to draft a simple contract with these like three terms. Have you thought about this? You know, should this be exclusive? You know, should we have unique rights here? Like, just, you know, don't just do the simple task as it came to you.
Right.
Ask questions, because a lot of times, you know, the business person hasn't thought of that.
Yeah.
And not only have they not thought of that, they appreciate you kind of going above and beyond, and like, wow, this Tim was actually spent time thinking about my business and brought ideas that I didn't even think about. I think that goes a long way. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you just gotta old fashioned put in the work. I mean, I think,
there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, just, you gotta respect your own schedule and you can't be taken advantage of. But I think, you know, if you're in the trenches, so to speak, with a business person, they really appreciate that. And they never forget that. And so, you know, we always joke about in-house, you know, sometimes we get brought in like, hey, Matt, we got to sign this contract tomorrow. And you're like, okay,
cool.
Like, give me one day. Great. You know, your fire drill is not always my fire drill, but usually it is my fire drill now.
Of course it is.
And so you're always going to have those situations, and you're going to have contracts that, or agreements or whatever, that, you know, you've got to spend some time in the evening, or the only time all the parties can get on the phone is Saturday morning. And that's not ideal. And again, you've got to respect your own personal, you know, time off as well. But there are times when it you just have to roll up the sleeves and you know, work late on an all hands call, whatever.
Yeah.
But I do think when you do those things strategically, the business folks, they don't forget that. Yeah. And that goes a long way. And it's showing that you're committed as well.
Yeah. So. And it's like a lot of people almost speak badly about like your identity being tied with your profession. But I mean, this is like, for most people, it's like a third of your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
For many, many years spent doing this, it's hard to not have it be part of your identity.
Yeah.
And if you're doing, I mean, most in-house lawyers I know really, really like their jobs.
Yeah.
And so like a Saturday morning call, while it's a little bit of a pain in the butt, it's not that bad.
It's not that bad.
It could be way worse.
Could be way worse. Yeah. You know, the thing that I appreciate about being in-house, one of the many things is, you know, you're going to have fire drills. You're going to work late sometimes. It's not always 9 to 5.
Right.
But I think when you're at a law firm, sometimes the fire drills come kind of out of nowhere. When you're in house, you got a little bit more visibility, and at least you kind of know what's coming, and that predictability makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there's not that many times where, you know, I'm about to be out of the office or going on a family vacation and something gets dropped to me like literally the day we're leaving and we can't go. I mean, that happens when you're at a big firm sometimes, right?
Sure.
That's part of the deal you make. I think in house, you just see things coming. You're able to plan a lot more, which that makes a big difference.
Yeah.
Less surprises usually.
Okay. Yeah.
That's awesome. In that vein, do you have any tips for work-life balance for yourself and for your team too?
It's a constant evaluation. Like I definitely haven't figured it out. I think coming out of COVID too, I think all of us are trying to figure out what's the right blend. You know, we used to have like much more of a separation of church and state. You know, you get out of the office, you take the train or you take the car home, and there's this natural half hour transition. And then you walk into the house and your kids attack you and you're into it. And now there's a lot of days where I'm walking upstairs from our office in the basement. And that transition is like 30 seconds. And that's hard. It's hard to kind of have those, how do you create natural, you know, sort of limits these days? You know, I try to you know, carve out time, you know, each day, hopefully to work out a little bit. And whether it's just like if it's a really crazy day and I can only get outside for like a 15 minute walk, just block that time and treat that time, whether it's working out, whether it's a quick meditation or whatever it is, you know, block the time on your calendar, right? Like that, you know, treat it like a meeting for yourself. And I think, you know, I'm a Peloton guy, and I think one of the instructors says like, you know, self-care is not selfish, right? And it's a little cheesy, but like having the idea of like, giving time to yourself is not wrong. It's not selfish. You're not like slacking. It allows you to be more present in your job. And I think that's important. But yeah, it's hard. It's hard to especially as an attorney, you know, you're in the client service business, whether you're in-house or at a law firm, and taking time to yourself does feel like I should always be working on a client thing. I should always be responding. But I think it's important to kind of block ahead, you know, look at your schedule. I'm open from 12 to 2. Okay, I'm going to block off 1 to 2.
Yeah.
And that's my time, right? And if someone says, hey, can I talk to you at 1:30? I'm going to say, no, I've got a meeting, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, that's great advice.
Yeah, hopefully my boss is not listening. No, I'm joking.
Well, we end every episode with some rapid-fire questions.
Sure, here we go.
If you're ready, what is your hot take on working in-house?
Yeah, I think it's really, really, if you're up for the challenge, it's really, really rewarding. We talked about, you know, being involved earlier and being involved later. And if you really kind of care about the business you're in, it's just really rewarding to feel like you're much more invested deeper into the business. I love it.
Awesome. What is your number one relationship building tip?
Be kind and respectful to everyone you work for, no matter what role they're in. You know, reputations are earned and they spread. And I think it's like the golden rule, right? Treat people like you want to be treated, no matter who they are. I always, you know, my last big firm, I had a great time there and was fortunate to work for some great partners. And I really, one of the things I took away was some of the partners I work for, it's easy to be nice to everybody when things are calm.
Yeah.
That's easy, right? Like, it's just like, it's like a freebie, but that's not, you know, what separates a true leader and a true good colleague and someone people want to be around and work with is how do you react when things get crazy? Because that's when things kind of get separated. And we've all worked for people that, you know, when things get crazy, lose their mind. They're saying like very like they just you can kind of tell like, hey, they've lost it. Don't talk to so-and-so today. And I think what's a good exercise for anyone who wants to be a leader is, okay, do I act the same way when things are crazy, right? And Do I still act respectful? And do I still act, you know, like a collegial colleague? And I think that's not easy to do sometimes. Yeah. We've all had times where we feel like, oh man, I'm starting to lose it. But I think that's what separates a true leader is everybody can be nice when things are calm, right? The start of the day.
That's right.
You know, how do you react when things go haywire, when you're talking to that aggressive New York, you know, attorney and he's reading you the Riot Act and your blood pressure is going up and you get a crazy timeline. You know, do you still treat everyone on your team with respect, right?
There's a mentor of mine very early in my career. He was like, listen, 90% of being a lawyer is putting up the appearance that everything is going exactly to plan and you know exactly what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
While internally, you're just simply panicking.
Yeah. Which is hard now with all the Zoom calls. Yeah. Like you used to be able to like be on a all hands call and like, you know, you'd be like, oh my God, or what is this person? And now like you kind of realize I can't do that. I've got to now I can't, just, not only can I not say it, I can't like express it.
Yeah. You got to have that poker face. Where it's like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I get it.
Yep. Yep.
What is the best career advice that you have ever given or received?
It's funny. My dad is a retired football coach. And so a lot of the advice I get from him is you've got to kind of translate that from like, okay, player coach advice to, you know, professional. And he used to always say, still does, no problems, no jobs. Yeah. Right. And so, you know, if you weren't solving problems or having problems at work, they don't need you. Yeah. And what are you doing? Right. And so I think we all have days where, you know, maybe the day went haywire, or we have a really hard problem and, you know, what are you going to do? And it kind of takes you off your game, but you're there to solve problems, right? Like if there wasn't a problem, they wouldn't need you to fix it. So,
right.
It's pretty, you know, it's cut and dry. It's four words, right? Not sure it's even really a full sentence, but, I do, it does kind of center me sometimes where things kind of get haywire. It's like, you know what, if I didn't have a problem here, I wouldn't have a job.
Yeah.
So.
And we close out every episode asking about a charity or a cause that's close to your heart that our listeners should check out
sure.
that we can amplify.
Yeah, this one's easy, just get recency. My wife and I started a foundation in December of last year called Jack Bear Foundation.
Okay.
We've got three kids. Our oldest is Jack, he's 10. He's got a very rare genetic disorder. It's Sarah, I'm not going to say it wrong, it's SCAR 15, but it's cerebellum ataxia recessive type 15. So it's a little bit of a mouthful, but SCAR 15.
Okay.
It's a global genetic disorder. You know, it affects speech, your gait, just your ability to kind of move around.
Okay.
But he's like the happiest kid ever. And you know, it took a while to figure out exactly what was causing his condition. So we've kind of gone through this journey where not knowing what the cause was, you know, how do we treat something we don't really know what's causing it. But our mission is to find treatment, you know, find a cure, raise awareness. You know, we've through my wife's primarily efforts, she's been amazing. You know, we've now know there's probably 10 or 11 families in the world that have this. We think there's a lot more, but it's a very new sort of known gene. And so our hope is that by raising awareness, more and more people figure out this is what my child's dealing with. This is what I'm dealing with. This is what my family member's dealing with.
Right.
So Jack Bear Foundation.
Awesome.
Awesome. Cool.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. This has been an awesome conversation. For the listeners, we'll see you next time.